Thank you. Good morning. I'm from Southern California, which means I'm cold. Amen. And I'm tired too because I'm time warped 3 hours. Right now, I'd still be in bed. My family still is in bed today. And you need to know I'm not a morning person. Actually, one woman said, "Mr. Kolkle, you must have a great quiet time in the morning." And I said, "Frankly, ma'am, before my first cup of coffee, I'm an atheist." Now, I had some coffee back at the hotel this morning. It was really weak, half a cup. So right now, I'm a Jehovah's Witness. still working on that one here. I get invited to speak to a lot of conferences, kind of like the one that's happening today, apologetics conferences. And they're great because we have really great people that are smart and have done a lot of studies and have answered just about every kind of challenge you can possibly imagine is leveled against Christianity today. We have a very deep bench. Fabulous. The problem with these conferences, though, is you go to them and you learn all this stuff and you start getting overwhelmed and you start feeling like the guy in the Far Side cartoon, you know? He's in a math class. There's all the formulas on the board, and he raises his hand and he says, "Professor, could I please be excused? My brain is full." Did you ever get that feeling? You're so overwhelmed by all the information, you don't know how you're going to get the information into play. And that's one of the reasons they asked me to conferences like this tactics conference, because what they want me to do is to provide them a way of taking all this information and getting it into play. In fact, there's a missing bridge in these conferences, a bridge from the content to the conversation, or a bridge from the scholarship to the relationship. And this is part of my role here today in a conference like this, is to provide that bridge. How do you get from the information you learn into a pleasant conversation that is effective and it looks more like diplomacy than D-Day, okay? That's what the tactical approach, in my view, is all about. And I'm going to focus on that for the day. But in order for me to make this transition, so to speak, I had to change my way of thinking about the whole evangelism project. And so what I'm going to offer this morning at this session is kind of a predicate to the larger tactical game plan that I'll talk about this afternoon in my sessions at the conference. And I'm going to tell you something right now that's going to surprise some of you. It's a kind of a confession I have to make. Here it is. I have not prayed with someone to receive Christ in over 30 years. I know what you're thinking. What a loser! Now, I will tell you that my change in thinking, though, has made my life much more effective for the cause of the gospel in the 30 years, all right? And it's because when I get in a conversation with somebody that I hope will lead to spiritual matters, I never have it as a goal to lead that person to Christ. In fact, I don't even have it as a goal to get to a gospel necessarily. Now, do I want that person to become a Christian? Absolutely. Does he need the gospel? Yes. The gospel is the power of salvation for all who believe. But I became a Christian during the Jesus movement back in 1973 in Southern California. And back then, evangelism was pretty easy. You go out on the beach or in the mall or at the university or whatever, you have a tract, you share the simple gospel, and you ask somebody if they want to receive Christ, and they pray the prayer, and you get a mark. All right, three people prayed with me today to receive Christ. Fabulous, all right? That was then. This is now. In case you haven't noticed, in 50 years, the culture has changed a lot. The culture has moved on, but our methods largely have not. A couple of things that have happened in the culture. For one, the gospel is no longer simple. Now, the gospel is still the gospel. That doesn't change. But to people's understanding, it's no longer simple. 50 years ago, you could say the basic things that pertain to the gospel, and people understood the words and they understood the meanings. Now they don't understand that. They don't know what you're talking about. I said to somebody once, "Jesus died for your sins," and he said, "Really? I'm sorry to hear that. Has he gotten better?" You know, that kind of thing. No understanding whatsoever. Actually, it's worse than that, because so many of the religious terms that we use with people now have not only no meaning in terms of substance, they have a negative connotation, and they're associated with hate and bigotry and intolerance, that kind of thing. So that's a big thing we have moving against us, lack of understanding of the basic concepts. Secondly, there are lots of books being written right now that is a full court press against virtually everything that is central to Christianity. Now, it isn't that people read all these books, but they know they're out there, and they think the smart guys have weighed in against Christianity, found it wanting, and so they're not even motivated to consider Christianity, which they think of in largely a negative fashion. Even though Christians are really nice, they still associate it with these bad ideas and bad thinking and bad attitude. Here's the third thing. If I were to spend my time here giving you a technique or a tool to help you communicate the simple gospel and get people to pray to receive Christ, well, you'd take notes and you'd laugh at my jokes and you'd say, praise the Lord, and then you wouldn't do it. You'd sit on the bench. And the reason that you wouldn't do it is because the idea of getting in a conversation where you're pressing for that end is frightening. And I understand that. I get it. Especially in the way the culture is now. It's always been a little intimidating, but now it's a lot worse. And so consequently, you're not going to get into play, and you're going to sit on the bench. Well, I don't think that's the wisest approach, what we did 50 years ago. And what I want to do is I want to give you an insight that has really significantly affected my entire approach to engaging people with the truth. And I engage people a lot, but my approach is very different. So I'm going to give you an aphorism. It's like a statement that really guides my thinking. And in a way, it's very simple, but if you once you see the role it will play maybe in influencing your approach, you'll see how profound it is. Here's the aphorism. Write this down. Before there can be any harvest, there always has to be a season of, let's just call it gardening, all right? Before there can be any harvest, there always has to be a season of gardening. Now, this is obvious in agricultural terms. It ought to be obvious also with regards to evangelism. Think of Jesus in John chapter 4. There's the woman at the well, famous account, a lot of sermons about that aspect, but I want to talk about what happens just after that. She goes off to Sychar. And the apostles come up to Jesus. And Jesus says to the apostles, you say there are 3 months and then comes the harvest. I'm saying look on the fields. They are white with harvest. Now, I don't think Jesus was saying that every field is always white with harvest. We know better. I think he was saying Sychar is ripe for harvest. And he says, you are about, watch the words, you are about to reap where you did not sow. You are about to reap where you did not sow. And so the proverb is fulfilled, Jesus says, one sows, another reaps. Now, I want you to think about what he says. What Jesus did is he identified one field, in that case, Sychar. But there were two seasons, sowing and reaping, gardening and harvesting, and two kinds of workers, sowers and reapers, gardeners and harvesters. And each is absolutely necessary. The disciples were coming into a circumstance where someone had done the gardening that was necessary. These folks were ready, and we saw a strong move towards Jesus as a result. And Jesus is telling them, you're going to reap here, you're going to harvest because the fruit is ready. I want you to think something about harvesting. 1973, September 28th, I became a Christian. My younger brother, Mark, was the one who was gardening a lot in my life at that time. And he came over to my apartment, and he began to tell me more about Jesus that evening. And I told him, Mark, you can stop talking about Jesus because I've already decided I want to become a Christian. It took me about 15 minutes to peel him off the ceiling, you know. And then I prayed a prayer, began to follow Christ. Okay? Notice, in my case, the fruit was ripe. What did Mark have to do? Nothing. He bumped up against the fruit. It fell right into the basket. Ripe fruit is easily harvested. When the time is right, bang, it happens. And many of you probably here can think of your own stories. In many cases, there wasn't even anybody with you. It was the influence of the gardening in your life by other people, your pastors, your friends, your family, whatever. And you came to that moment of putting your full trust and commitment in Christ. That's what Jesus is talking about. Now, I made a comment a few moments ago, probably shocked some of you. I haven't prayed with somebody to receive Christ in over 30 years. But I want you to notice something. Have you ever heard, some of you heard of a person named J. Warner Wallace? Many hands there. Wrote a best-selling Christian book called Cold Case Christianity. See, he was a cold case cop in Los Angeles, a storied one. Four of his cases were on the subject of TV shows because he never lost a case that went to trial. And Jim Wallace was an atheist who began to use his detective skills and apply them to the New Testament. And when he did that, he realized the eyewitness testimony in the New Testament documents could be trusted. He gave himself to Christ, and now he's a traveling speaker, writing three best-selling books in apologetics now, Cold Case Christianity, God's Crime Scene, and Forensic Faith, and still writing. J. Warner Wallace, atheist now turned Christian apologist, was in my garden. Because Jim was listening to my radio show when he was still an atheist. Anybody hear of Abdu Murray? Former Muslim who became a Christian. Now senior vice president of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. Abdu was in my garden. He was listening to our radio show when he was still a Muslim. Now, I didn't lead those men to Christ. I know them well now, but I found out later that I was played a role in the gardening in their life. And this is the kind of thing I'm getting at. You don't know who's in your garden. If you garden faithfully, the Holy Spirit has the ability to take all of that and transform people. But in this case, in J. Warner Wallace and Abdu Murray, you know what happened? Somebody went into my garden and harvested my fruit. Do you think I care? No. Jesus says, John 4, so that the one who reaps and the one who sows can rejoice together. So what I want to invite you to do is to think of yourself in a different role. Not as a hard-pressing evangelist going for the gold, trying to get somebody to sign on the dotted line. Some of you do that naturally, you're fine. But for most of you, I think if that's what's expected of you, you're going to sit on the bench. Okay? I want you to think of yourself more in terms of being a gardener. And I'll tell you why. As I look back on my life over 46 years now as a follower of Christ, I realize I'm a gardener. That what I'm doing when I'm speaking at universities, 82 now, the number's gone up. As I'm writing books, dressing conferences, whatever, radio show 30 years. Now, what am I doing? I'm gardening. That's all I'm doing because I'm a gardener. I am not a harvester. And I'm happy to be a gardener. And I suspect since before there can be a harvest, there always has to be a season of gardening. And when the harvest is ready, it's easy to harvest. Most of the work is being done in the gardening area, which means most of the workers, it seems to me, are gardeners and not harvesters. Probably most here are gardeners, but you never thought of yourself in that way, and so haven't given yourself most effectively to the gardening aspect. How do we do that? How do we make a bridge from the content of the conversation? How do we get involved with people in a way that it's not pressure, 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 but still makes a difference for Christ? Well, you need a game plan. And I'm going to go into detail about the game plan later this afternoon, plenary sessions after lunch, talking in particular about the game plan, which I outline in this book called Tactics, A Game Plan for Discussing. There it is, your Christian convictions. By the way, if you get it, be sure to get the one with the little red thing here, because that's the 10th anniversary edition. It's 40% larger than the first edition 10 years ago. Almost twice as many tactics. And if you've got the early book, it's really great, but buy this one too. Just say it. What I want to do today is I want to give you a game plan. And my promise for those who go to the sessions, I can't do the whole thing now. There's not enough time. I only got 15 minutes to go here. I could introduce it. But my promise for the duration is I'm going to give you a game plan that will allow you to converse with confidence in any situation. No matter how little you think you know, or how knowledgeable, or aggressive, or even obnoxious the other person happens to be. Now, it's a game plan that trades on some advice that Paul gives in Colossians chapter 4, verse 5 and 6. So write that down. You can check it out later. I'll recite it for you here. Colossians 4, verse 5 and 6. And here's what Paul says there. He says, conduct yourself with wisdom towards outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. All right, so he starts out by saying, first be smart. All right. Then he says, let your speech always be with grace, seasoned as it were with salt. So he says, be smart. Then he says, be nice. What a concept. And then he closes and he says, so that you will know how to respond to each person. So that you will know how to respond to each person. So Paul says, be smart. Then he says, be nice. Then he says, be tactical. And his point is that human beings are individuals. And though there might be some value to kind of a very tightly scripted interaction, and God uses that, and sometimes it's helpful, especially if you're a beginner, what Paul is emphasizing there is treating people as individuals in their individual station in life, at their individual set of beliefs, in their individual set of concerns and pushbacks and objections to Christianity. Be smart, be nice, but be tactical. I want to give you an example of what that looks like from an experience I had a number of years ago. I grew up in Chicago, actually, so my blood should be thicker than it is, although I've been almost 50 years in Southern Cal now. And my grandpa was a lumberjack in northern Wisconsin, so he purchased some property up there that he wanted to retire at. And I used to go up there as a kid all the time, and now it's my property, and I still go up there because I like to fish. And I'm a bass fisherman when I get a chance, but up north I like to fish for smallmouth bass. And one day I went out and I caught the largest smallmouth of my life while I was fishing in a boat with a local pastor. Now that fish was 4 pounds, 2 ounces, which is a pretty big smallie for that neck of the woods. Now I just have to say that since then I got 8 fish over 5, just saying. And one was 3 ounces shy of 6, and if it had eaten just one more crawdad, I would have had a 6, right? In any event, I was really proud of that fish, and the pastor took a snap of it, and I wanted to get that digitized to put up on the screen at his church that I was going to be speaking at the following Sunday. So we took the film, F-I-L-M, to be developed at the local kiosk, right? So they digitized it. I put it up on the screen the following weekend. But when we were there, was a young lady that was working at the kiosk, and I noticed that she had a large piece of jewelry hanging from her neck. It was a pentagram, a five-pointed star. And five-pointed stars are oftentimes occultic symbols, but I didn't know in this case. And so I asked her, I said, does that jewelry have religious significance? And she said, yes, it does. The 5 points stand for earth, wind, fire, water, and spirit. Okay, so the bells are going off in my head here a little bit, but I had another question I wanted to ask her. I said, what I really want to know is whether that star or that pentagram, that jewelry, has religious significance for you personally. And she said, yes, I'm a pagan. Now, my wife, I'm a trained professional, right, so I'm taking this in stride, but my wife was standing next to me, and she got caught by surprise by that. And when this girl identifies herself, a young lady, as a pagan, then my wife started to laugh. Then she caught herself. She said, "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to embarrass you, but I never heard anybody admit it before." That's what she said. She'd only heard the word pagan from her girlfriends when they call her kids in. "Get in here, you bunch of pagans," you know, that kind of thing. So the young lady was not offended. She went on to explain it's an earth religion. And as she's given an explanation, I realize I'm talking to a witch. And so I asked her, "Are you Wiccan?" And she said, "Yes, I am." She said, we respect all life. So she's beginning to explain something about the theology of Wicca. And I thought, well, you respect all life. And I said this to her, well, that would make you probably pro-life with regards to the abortion question, wouldn't it? She said, "No, actually, I'm pro-choice." I said, "Really? Isn't it unusual for a witch to be pro-choice? I mean, my understanding is that most witches are actually pro-life because of their foundational theological commitment." And she said, "Yeah, it is a little bit unusual." And then she said this. Then she said, "I know I could never do that," referring to abortion. "I could never kill a baby." That was her exact words. Now, it stands to reason the organization I represent, we have training regarding the abortion issue to demonstrate that abortion takes the life of an innocent human being without proper justification. Baby killing, if you will, but we don't use that language because we don't want people to think we are trying to make our points with rhetoric rather than with good arguments, okay? But in this conversation, I'm the pro-lifer. I'm not the one who's calling abortion baby killing. It is the person who believes in abortion that is acknowledging that abortion is killing a baby. She said it, I didn't say it. And guess what? I'm listening. It's a very important part of this whole project. I'm paying attention. And so do you think now I am going to talk anymore about abortion with her? No, I'm going to talk about what? Baby killing. Because that is the language she introduced and she used. She said, I would never do that. I could never kill a baby," is what she said. And then she gave a reason why. She said, "I wouldn't want something bad to come back on me, you know." Now, I don't know about you guys, but that sounds to me like an odd reason not to kill a baby. I'm not going to kill anybody. You never know what's going to happen to you when you do that, you know. Well, maybe it's just we should just not kill babies, you know, whatever. But I didn't pursue that. I went a different direction with this conversation. I said, well, maybe you wouldn't kill babies. I'm thinking, good. But maybe we should keep other people from killing babies. And she said, I think people should have a choice. I said, okay. What is the choice, by the way, that we're talking about here? Explicitly now, on her terms, the choice to what? Kill babies, right. And so I asked her, you mean people should have a choice to kill babies? And she said, well, I think all things should be taken into consideration. Pardon me for chuckling here, but the more I think about this conversation, it's just weird, isn't it? She said, I think all things should be taken into consideration. I said, okay, what would be a legitimate consideration to make it okay to kill a baby? And she immediately said, incest. Now, I want you to notice what's going on so far. She's trotting out all of the pro-choice slogans. However, she has already acknowledged that abortion is baby killing, so that all of these slogans are now slogans in favor of baby killing and not just the more ambiguous abortion. And it's starting to sound a little bit weird. But she doesn't see it because she's not paying attention to herself. She's just citing slogans. And by the way, both sides do this. Non-Christians on a whole host of issues like this one and Christians on a whole host of issues like this one. We recite slogans instead of having meaningful conversation with people. So I said to her, let me see if I understand your view. Now, I didn't have any children at that time. Now, I have two. I have a 15-year-old daughter and a 12-year-old daughter. And I know what you're thinking. That's weird. He's an old guy. How did that happen? I can't remember. I'd like to remember. Well, how old is he anyway? I can't remember that either. I try to work with smaller numbers right now, so I'm in my fifth Medicare year, if that helps. I don't know. But I said to her, let me see if I understand your view. If I had a two-year-old standing next to me who had been conceived by incest, then on your view, I should be allowed to kill this baby. Is that right? Now, let me ask you a question. Was that a fair application of the view that she shared with me? Yes, I think it was. In fact, I was giving her now an opportunity with my question to clarify if I'd misunderstood, but I hadn't misunderstood. That was her view. And it caused her to pause for a moment. And this is the time when I put a stone in her shoe. Because what I didn't explain is now my goal has changed. My goal is not to necessarily get to the gospel or win that person to Christ in that circumstance, in that conversation. My more modest goal is to just annoy them a little bit. Put a stone in their shoe. In fact, whenever I speak to a non-Christian audience at a university, for example, this is the way I always start. I say I'm here tonight because my life has been deeply changed by an ancient teacher. The name is Jesus of Nazareth. And 40-some years ago, while a student at UCLA, I made a decision to follow him because as I thought about the things that he said about the world, reality, claims he made about himself, and the claim that he made on my own life, I finally came to the conclusion that Jesus got it right, that the smart money was on him, and I began to follow him. It hasn't been easy, I tell them, but it's been reality. And then I say, but I'm not here today to convert you. Collective sigh of relief. I have a different goal. Here's my goal, I tell the audience. I just want to put a stone in your shoe. I just want to annoy you. They all start laughing because they expect the Christian to annoy them. All right, I'm your guy. But you're going to thank me, I hope, when we're done. I just want to annoy you in a little way. I want you walking out of here with something that I've said sticking at you. I want to get you thinking. And by the way, in any conversation that I'm having with somebody, that's my goal. My goal is to just do a little, what's the word? Gardening. I just want to give them something to think about, something to commend Christianity to them, something maybe to correct a misunderstanding, something to cause some doubt in their own point of view. I just want to do a little gardening. I want to put a stone in their shoe. And at this point in the conversation with the witch in Wisconsin, she stops after I gave that illustration and asked that question about the two-year-old. On your view, I should be able to kill this two-year-old, right? And she paused for a long time, and then she says, I'd have mixed feelings about that. And I'm thinking, good, at least they're mixed, you know. Now, I notice that the line is growing behind me, right? And I'm interfering with her work product. And so I know that the opportunity for my conversation, my gardening, is finished. Now, had I been of a different way of thinking, I might have thought to myself and said to the, look, I haven't got to the gospel yet. Sit down, shut up, maybe you learn something, and off I go. But you see, I wasn't under that pressure. I wouldn't consider myself a failure if I didn't get to the gospel, if I didn't challenge that person to receive Christ. In that case, I would have been jerking on fruit that wasn't ready to be harvested yet. It might have caused more harm than good. And so with this goal of just putting a stone in their shoe, I pursued the conversation. And by the way, I want you to notice something about that conversation. I asked 9 different questions. I asked questions to get information from her. I asked questions to understand her point of view. I even used questions to exploit what I thought was a weakness or a flaw in her view. And this is the power of the tactical approach. And notice in this circumstance, I wasn't doing any work. She wasn't doing any work. We weren't fighting. We weren't banging heads. We weren't guarding turf. There were no lines drawn in the sand. We were just having a friendly conversation. And that's exactly the way I want it. And this is the power of taking a tactical approach. Now, I want to introduce the basic concept of the game plan to you. I'm going to go in a lot more detail later this afternoon, and I hope you come to the conference. If you haven't planned on doing so, I hope you change your plans, okay? Because that's when I'm going to give the full-throated game plan that will help you to maneuver in any conversation really well. But there is a core tactic. We have tactics called suicide and take the roof off and just the facts, ma'am, and steamroller and inside out and what a friend we have of Jesus and sticks and stones. These are all maneuvers that will help manage a conversation. They're not to manipulate people. That's not the point. To help you manage the conversation. But there is one tactic that is the core of the game plan that the other tactics serve. It's the simplest tactic imaginable to allow you to stop a challenger in their tracks, to turn the tables, to get them thinking, and to put you in the driver's seat of the conversation. And that's the goal of the tactical approach. You want to be in the driver's seat of the conversation. And this tactic has a name, and the name of the tactic is Columbo. Now, I run a risk here, looking at all these young faces. How many people know who Lieutenant Columbo is? Bravo! Oh, that warms the cockles of my heart. He goes back 40 years ago on television, but he was a detective. He had a trench coat like this, looked like he slept in it. I got mine from the Salvation Army. My wife says, whenever you buy something from the Salvation Army, you always got to check the pockets because you never know what you're going to find when you... Wait a minute, what's this? Oh my gosh, look at that! Lieutenant Columbo has a cigar. Now look it. This is plastic. No worries. In fact, I hate cigars, personally. Whenever I find a real cigar, I always destroy it. By fire. I'm not going to go there, though. He also had a pad of paper, right? Can't use his pad of paper. Why not? Because he doesn't have a pen or pencil. He's got to bum that off of somebody. He's wandering around scratching his head. I mean, this guy doesn't look like he can think his way out of a wet paper bag. He's stupid. But he's stupid like a fox because he's got a plan, right? At some point, he'll put his hand to furrowed brow like he's deep in troubled thought. And he'll say something like this. I don't know. There's something about this thing that bothers me. Do you mind if I ask you a question? So he asks a question, right? Gets the answer back. You're very intelligent. Oh. One more thing. And then he one more tings him to death, right? Question after question. They start getting annoyed, even upset. He says, I'm sorry. It's because I'm asking all these questions, but I can't help it. It's a habit. And this is a habit that you ought to get into. The key to the Columbo tactic is that the Christian goes on the offensive in an inoffensive way with carefully selected questions that advance the conversation. Let me say that again. The key to this tactic and the entire tactical approach to the entire tactical game plan is that you go on the offensive in an inoffensive way with carefully selected questions that advance the conversation. Now, I can't go into the details. There's three phases or steps of the game plan. They're very precise, very specific, and very easy to follow, and very, very effective. That I'll cover in the sessions that I have in the conference. And if you can't come to the conference, I don't know, you could always buy the book. Did I mention I wrote a book on it? I'm just so... But what I want you to know is that the key to it all, the key to keeping everything relaxed, the key to keeping you safe if you're timid or if you're shy or if you're retiring, the key to the whole game plan's effectiveness is asking questions. When you are asking questions to gain information from the other person about themselves, to gain information about their point of view, to get more clarity on what their objection is, happens to be. I'm just going to tell you, I know this from experience for a couple, almost two decades of doing this, one decade with the book, and thousands of people who have talked to me about their experience putting this into play. Just asking questions has a powerful impact on people. Jesus asked over 300 questions in the Gospels. You will be amazed at what the Holy Spirit will do just at the first stage of gathering information by using questions. You're not preaching. You're not trying to affect, in a sense, doesn't feel like you're evangelizing. Doesn't feel like that to the other person. You're not thumping them on the head or on the chest and tell them they're wrong and you're right. You're just having a relaxed, friendly conversation. But the questions you use will change everything. Look, if you ever get stuck in a circumstance, take a tip from Lieutenant Colombo and always ask questions. Thank you.